This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm joined this week with Siraj Hashmi. Hey, Siraj.
Hey, Rabia. How you doing?
I'm alive. I'm hanging in there. Our listeners are probably wondering, what is going on? The whole week has gone by. Where's the 45th? And I'm just going to pull back the curtain a little bit. It has been a week from hell for almost everybody. The way it all went down was, I knew I was going to be traveling. I had to go to Vegas for a panel that I was doing, and I said, Susan, you know, you take the helm. She said, not a problem. I got this. Me and Waj and Siraj will do it. Come time to record earlier this week, her and Wajahat had like a virus from death. I took a red eye back from Vegas, and I basically didn't sleep for like 48 hours because I thought I could sleep on a plane, but guess what? I can't. And so basically, Siraj, thank you so much. Siraj is the one who's held it down this whole week. He's been patiently waiting. Just patiently waiting for somebody to talk to about what's going on and pull
no
together.
Nobody will
like,
ever talk to me.
Nobody will talk to you. Well, I do like to talk to you on Twitter. But anyway, I finally got some sleep last night. Woke up to a vomiting baby. It is what it is. You guys, our listeners know. Our listeners know. They are with us. They are our family. They understand the ups and downs. But Siraj has put together a great list of things to talk about because I know a lot's been going on. I've been watching from periphery. So let's get right into it.
So, top of the news here, I guess we'll start off with the most late breaking stuff. And that's immigration, which, I mean, it's been going on and off all of the last couple of weeks.
I mean, it breaks every day.
But there's a story in The Washington Post about basically White House officials have tried to pressure U.S. immigration authorities to release detainees onto the streets of sanctuary cities to retaliate against President Trump's political adversaries, according to DHS officials and email messages reviewed by the Post. Apparently, Trump administration officials have proposed transporting detained immigrants to sanctuary cities at least twice in the last 6 months, once in November as a migrant caravan approached the U.S. southern border, and again in February amid a standoff with Democrats over funding for Trump's border wall. And I will just stop in saying that I don't understand really what the point of it was, but Rabia, please, I'd like to hear what your immediate thoughts were on that.
I have mixed feelings about this. Initially, I was like, well, you know what? Sanctuary cities is where probably these people would be the most comfortable and safe. So I'm all for that. But the bigger issue here is not where they are, like, quote, released, but what he's trying to do here. This is like a retaliatory thing for him. I mean, just like, you know, now the war cry and witch hunt for, you know, who started the investigation against Trump, you know, he's going to exact political revenge. And that's what this was about. And that's what's problematic, is that we have a president who thinks it's OK to do that. Also, by the way, it completely undermines his entire national security, national emergency threat, right? Like, on one hand, he's saying these are dangerous people. He just recently said, I think it was last week, it was horrific. He said,
right,
they're not people, they're animals. He's calling immigrants animals. Well,
hold up. Sorry, that quote right there, just to stop you right there, because I have fact-checked that one. That was from May 2018, and he was specifically answering a question from Fresno County sheriff, with respect to MS-13 gang members, because
really,
the question, I don't know how people forgot about this, but this was widely covered in May of 2018. And
it's not even a forgot thing. It's just that he has said things like this so many times. It's hard to keep track.
He's demonized.
Why was it reported then?
I think he's used inflammatory rhetoric and incendiary rhetoric against immigrants all the time. I mean, you know, just starting off with his campaign announcement in June of 2015, we referred to Mexicans as, murderers and rapists. But that specific comment that people were getting infuriated about was specifically focused on MS-13 gang members.
I
don't know how it got rehashed now, and it seems like it's getting relitigated, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I don't know. MS-13 they're definitely, I mean, they are horrific. It is a horrific, horrific.
If anything, like animals is a generous characterization for MS-13.
They're pretty, Yeah, they're right up there with ISIS in many ways. But let me go back to what I'm trying to say is, like, for him to argue on one, and we know them, he's called a national emergency. The administration is arguing that that these countries are sending the worst of their people. He has argued over and over again that there are rapists and murderers and criminals coming through these caravans, immigrating, trying to get asylum. And now he's saying he's going to release the detainees. And I wonder if, like, what do you think the retaliation is here? Is to put a tax burden on those cities? Is to increase crime rates in those cities? What is he
could be? Them? I mean, it could be a number of those things. It could also just be sort of, spreading resources too thin. So right. You obviously increase the population size of an area and you're not anticipating, obviously, housing for those people, services like hospitals, education, even things like, I don't even know if this would apply here, but, you know, all the social safety net benefits that some people could get. I'm not 100% sure. I know you're the immigration lawyer here, and I don't know what undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, generally they can't. You can't if you're not documented. I mean, like in certain jurisdictions, you'd be like a citizen or a green card holder, even if you're a documented immigrant, like a legal immigrant, but you're not a green card or permanent. You're not a permanent resident, a citizen. You can't qualify for the safety nets. But it doesn't mean there isn't some, there isn't spending by the city or the state or municipality. Sure. Because, you know, you have public schools, you have school lunch programs that people can qualify for. There are other kinds of social services, emergency medical services, things like that. And yet, certainly a lot of immigrants, whether or not they're documented, are putting millions of tax dollars back into the system. But it doesn't mean if you dump suddenly, let's say, I don't know, 500 people, 500 new people in the city, if there'll be enough work there for that to even happen.
Yeah, and that's another thing is it was also interesting that I don't know if you mentioned this or if I mentioned this, but one of the areas that Trump administration officials wanted to bust these undocumented immigrants to was to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's district in San Francisco. So, And already Republicans and conservatives rail against San Francisco for things like their homelessness problem. So think about, how bad that could get if, undocumented immigrants are shipped over there and, they don't have a place to stay. They don't have relatives. It's a completely, obviously, foreign territory to them. But like they literally have to start from scratch. I mean, where do they go? So, yeah, I guess I could see the kind of pettiness of that move. And I don't see what it would do to help Trump's immigration problem. I mean, I've kind of gone on the airwaves and I've talked about how, and we'll get to the DHS staff shakeup in a minute, but, things have just arguably gotten worse on immigration for Trump. And there are many of Trump's supporters who are actual hardliners on immigration who actually voted for Trump because they thought he was going to build a border wall, who are so disillusioned by Trump's policies on immigration. They think he's actually the weakest on immigration compared to, Obama and Bush, which is, if you could believe it, that's good.
Yeah. Well, the reason I can believe it is because the numbers are probably telling that story. I mean, just I understand that last month, about 100,000 migrants have been apprehended just last month, at the border. And it just seems like the numbers are increasing, which is exactly opposite of what this administration was hoping to do with deterrence, like family separation and not accepting asylum applications. We are getting increasing numbers. And I, there's a part of me that wonders about the numbers, how accurate they are, but also if they are accurate, then it means there is something happening. There are conditions that are changing in the countries where these people are coming from that is leading to exodus.
It's also seasonal. Because it is getting warmer. It's easier to travel. Apparently, human traffickers or smugglers have been putting out ads saying, and this has a lot to do with what Trump has done on immigration, his threats to shut down the border, because that's actually played very well with smugglers who are basically said, if you want to get into the United States, go now, because Trump's going to shut down the border in a year.
It's like criminalizing pot, right?
It's just like a surge. Just buy all the pot you can get now because you have no idea if you can get it legally. So it's one of those things where Trump has he's really shot himself on the foot here. I mean, I don't think Trump should shut down the border, but even issuing that threat, with respect to, you know, saying that if Mexico doesn't get it together, which, by the way, Mexico is a sovereign nation. They could police their own border. They don't have to do our dirty work for us. And we shouldn't have to rely solely on Mexico to try to curb illegal immigration. When you and I both know that most illegal immigrants, or at least undocumented immigrants, I should say, are here in the country because they overstay their visas.
Yeah, that's the truth. That's the truth. And, you know, it's interesting when you pointed out the seasonal thing. The other seasonal reason for maybe this kind of uptick, and I'd have to go back and look at, like, you know, past years and how this happens, is because we have seasons where our farms need more seasonal workers and hired hands. And where do you think they come from? Who do you think is doing all that work? I mean, picking your strawberries and your oranges and planting stuff. I mean, like, there is an entire season where, you know, the farms will die if these workers don't get in.
And another thing here, and this is just something that we don't really talk about that much in terms of immigration, but big business is very much in favor of letting things remain the same because they stand to benefit the most from undocumented or illegal immigration because they're getting such low wage labor that it keeps their profit margins up.
You guys, I have to tell you about this service that is not new to me, but might be new to a lot of you, and I love it so much. It's called Framebridge. I am that person, I swear to you. I end up buying prints and printing pictures and getting things that I want to get framed, never get around to framing them for a number of reasons. First of all, it's always kind of a pain in the butt to go to the store, try to figure out what frame works, what doesn't work. But then custom framing costs so much. That's where Framebridge comes in. Just go to framebridge.com. You upload your picture, or they'll, like, if you have a digital picture, you just upload it. They'll frame it, send it to you. Or if you have a physical picture, they'll send you a package and you can safely mail in your physical pieces. Then you can preview your item online in any frame style. So you can be like, let me see what it looks like in this. Let me see what it looks like in this. You can even get recommendations from their own designers. The expert team at Framebridge custom frames your item and delivers it directly to your door. It's ready to be hung. You don't have to deal with putting that wire on the back. That it is just put up a nail, put up a hook, and just hang it. I love my pieces that have been framed by Framebridge. I use them to frame two beautiful art pieces from Pakistan they do this gorgeous truck art in South Asia that's made out of, I don't even know how to explain it, like this hammered metal and paint. And I didn't know how to frame it. So I was like, here you go, Framebridge, take care of this for me. And they just look beautiful. People love them. They're in these gorgeous silver frames. So instead of paying hundreds, you pay at a framing store. Their prices are they start at $39. It's ridiculous. And the shipping is free. And our listeners get 15% off your first order at framebridge.com when they use our code 45th. So get started today. Frame your photos or send the perfect gift for weddings, special events, holidays, whatever. And Mother's Day is coming up, by the way. So go to framebridge.com and use the promo code 45th. You'll save an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com, promo code 45th. Once again, that's framebridge.com, promo code 45th. I mean, I'll say this. There's a big concern about, and I can understand this kind of concern, like, you know, the kind of burden, the kind of tax burden that just huge amounts of immigrants, but we have very carefully allocated, like, you know, the number of visas that we know for all across the, like, whether it's high tech visas, like H-1B visas, whether it's asylum visas, all these things have been allocated, taking into consideration the economy, what we can handle, but also what our needs are, what our workforce needs. And people have to understand, you can't just, I'll just give you a very brief, like, sure, kind of like journey of the asylee, right? So you come into the country, you apply for asylum. If you get asylum, you'll get your green card a little bit later, you get qualified. And then 5 years later, you can apply for your citizenship. But to apply for citizenship, you know what you have to show? You have to show good moral standing. I have not committed, you know, certain categories of crimes, and then I file my taxes. And so you have to show that you're making an income, that you're paying taxes. I mean, there are requirements that are built into the system that help ensure that this will not be a financial burden the country can't take. And people don't see the bigger, longer picture. It also takes forever to get through the process. I mean, it takes maybe 8 years to become a citizen, right?
Yeah.
So, but I want to move on to, let's talk about the state shakeup. Yeah, it was big news.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So, 2 days. So this happened a week. Today's Friday, and we're recording on Friday. A week ago. So this is Friday, April. What's today? The 12th. So April 5th. So basically, the White House announced that they're pulling the nomination of acting ICE Director, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Ron Vitello. He's been serving as the acting director since June 2018. And then 2 days later, on Sunday, President Trump forced the resignation. I say forced, but he probably just fired. DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. And a day later, Trump removed Randolph Tex Allis as the director of Secret Service. And people don't fully understand where Secret Service lies. It actually lies under DHS. So that's three in DHS, people in the span of 4 days, in which he had, you know, a major shakeup, focusing not only on immigration, but also protection of the White House and, you know, all the properties that that Trump visits, like Mar-a-Lago. Now, starting off with Vitello, his nomination was reportedly pulled because he disagreed with Trump's proposal to shut down the border. Mm. And not 100% sure who pushed that, but a number of outlets have reported that it was Stephen Miller who forced Trump's hand on that. And
I mean, I think Miller's been like, you know, he's been puppet master on all things immigration since he's got in.
I'm not 100% sure because I think
he wrote a lot of the policies, and that's why he got.
Yeah, but I think his influence has been waning in the last few months, ever since the child separation policy was a complete disaster for them. I think Trump has sort of gone with his own instinct, and I think that's why you're not seeing much going on in terms of actual policy being pushed forward, and he's just kind of making empty threats like shutting down the border. But then Nielsen was reportedly fired for, and this is, she was fired for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, Trump declared a national emergency on the southern U.S. border under her watch. I think if, obviously, you could probably look at it in context with, he declared a national emergency in order to get funding from the DOD, from Treasury, as well as, there was one other program that was off the top of my, on the tip of my tongue that I can't name right at the moment, but it was basically in the rough shot around $4.7 billion that he could get to build the border wall, in addition to the $1.4 billion he was getting from Congress for border security. Secondly, DHS was continuing the catch and release policy that he tried to end because detention centers were overflowing with migrants. And I think there was a story in either the New York Times or Washington Post in the last couple of weeks showing that now acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleenan, who is the commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, saying that they've had to basically use facilities that weren't really, like, they basically had to co-opt like people's homes and stuff like that and use military bases to try to house some of these undocumented immigrants that they were detaining because they were getting upwards of 4,000 a day. And one facility, I think in Texas, had somewhere around 13,000 migrants detained, which is absolutely unprecedented.
Incredible. Yeah.
And then thirdly, which is the most important, and this is why he fired Nielsen, was because of the 2020 presidential election. And the reason I say this is because, number one, the wall isn't built. And that's the staple of Trump's campaign. Without saying anything about a wall, he probably would be a flash in the pan in the 2016 Republican primary. And Trump needs a DHS secretary who's more in lockstep with him. So there have been.
But was she not in lockstep? I mean, it's one thing that she couldn't effectuate anything, but she completely was, it seemed, in lockstep. She defended every single one of these awful policies, every single one of these strategies.
But she also, and this is one thing that I think Trump would probably disagree with, or that they would disagree with each other, with respect to DACA. She went on the record, I believe, with CBS in February or March of 2018, saying that they would not prioritize deportation of DACA recipients who, if DACA expires, which it did, that they would prioritize deportation of them, which Trump probably would want her to prioritize. So
I've always thought for him, DACA was just a bargaining chip that he really doesn't care too much about. I think for him, DACA, that's an easy negotiating point that he would give into, but
yes,
that's it.
Trump hardliners do not see Kirstjen Nielsen as in lockstep with Trump on immigration.
So it's fair to say she's not evil enough. That's what's going on.
I mean, if that's how you want to part, I mean, if that's how you want to
trade. That's exactly how I want to see it.
Immigration hardliners believe that she absolutely hurt Trump more than she helped him. So, and then Alice,
what are we looking at?
Oh,
who's going to replace her? Or are we going to, because we're now in the situation where there's so many agencies that have acting directors, acting secretaries, like he's not having to do a nomination process. It almost seems like he's doing this on purpose to usurp congressional authority and any kind of, you know, checks and balances.
So there have been a number of ideas for replacing Nielsen. Top of the list, and I didn't write this down in our outline, but it's Rick Perry, who's the energy secretary. And the reason why he would be a possible fit there is because he's kept his head down. For one, he's been very uncontroversial while he's been the energy secretary. I mean, there's barely any headlines on him. If anything, there have been more memes about him visiting people in the Middle East than there have been about headlines, or negative headlines, I should say. And then secondly, he was a three-term Texas governor, so he understands the complexities of border and immigration issues. And then thirdly, he actually passed a Senate confirmation process when, you know, it was the height of, you know, I wouldn't say animosity, but sort of partisanship with respect to not, you know, confirming Trump appointees to all these different federal agencies. You know, Betsy DeVos was one, Jeff Sessions was another. But Rick Perry got through with like a 2/3 majority. He got like in with like a 67-32 split.
Right.
And then, so he's a possible one. Immigration hardliners, Trump supporters, they're not big on Rick Perry, but he's the arguably the only one who could really get through a Senate confirmation. You're looking at two other people, like Kris Kobach, who was the former Kansas Secretary of State. You may recall him. Meeting then President-elect Donald Trump in November of 2016, and he had like this list that was out on display outside this folder that all the, you know, AP and Getty got glimpses of, and it was, you know, they're focusing on his immigration plan, and he ran for governor of Kansas, and he seemed like a sure bet to win, and then ended up losing to a Democrat in the 2018 election. And he is not a likely nominee because he doesn't have many friends in the Senate, and his nomination would certainly tank. Same case for Ken Cuccinelli, who's the former Virginia Attorney General. And he is not a huge... I should say Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is not a huge fan of Cuccinelli because Cuccinelli has basically taken out ads and called for the resignation of McConnell as recently as October of 2017.
Well, that would do
Cuccinelli,
it.
And also Cuccinelli backed Roy Moore for the Alabama Senate race in 2017. So he doesn't have many allies in the Senate. Pam Bondi, who's a former Florida Attorney General, her name has been floating around. Even acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleen, and you can't really rule his name out as a permanent replacement, but I think he has probably the smallest chance of being nominated. So right now, my money's on Rick Perry. Yeah, I don't know about you. What do you think?
I think Perry would make the best candidate of this slate, at least. But having said that, I don't think Perry would be in lockstep with this. I mean, for the president, what he needs is complete, unadulterated, you know what I mean? Like just
loyalty.
And I feel like Perry wouldn't be able to do it because Perry is more informed on these issues.
Right.
And I don't know if that's what Trump necessarily wants. He doesn't care about, that's not his, the only qualification that matters to him is that somebody execute his command and give him the
right
results,
whether
he wants,
it breaks the law or not.
Right.
And that's the big thing is, what, you know, how far is a Trump nominee willing to go? Are they willing to get entangled more with the law and possibly get, I don't know, held under contempt by Congress or censured? I don't know.
You mean like, I don't know, sounds like somebody we might know, like maybe our Attorney General William Barr. Let's talk about that.
That's okay. All right. So
let's talk about the Barr hearing.
So during a Senate hearing this week, Attorney General William Barr told lawmakers that he believed there was spying on the Trump campaign during the 2016 presidential election by the FBI.
And right, and that he is going to he's going to open, or he has opened, an investigation into the origins of the Trump investigation.
So back in March 2017, Trump accused the Obama administration of spying on his campaign by wiretapping Trump Tower.
Well, you know, for the same reason we're worried about foreign influence in elections, we want to make sure that during an election, I think spying on a political campaign is a big deal. It's a big deal. Generation I grew up in, which was the Vietnam War period, you know, people were all concerned about spying on anti-war people and so forth by the government. And there were a lot of rules put in place to make sure that there's an adequate basis before our law enforcement agencies get involved in political surveillance. I'm not suggesting that those rules were violated, but I think it's important to look at that. And I'm not talking about the FBI necessarily, but intelligence agencies more broadly.
So you're not suggesting, though, that spying occurred.
I don't. I guess you could. I think there's a spying did occur.
Both the FBI and NSA has denied that those claims are accurate. So, Robbie, my question to you is: this another baseless smear, or is there some truth to Trump and Barr's claims?
Okay, here's the thing. here's the thing. I mean, it's all a matter of framing. If the FBI and NSA were wiretapping Trump Tower because they thought there is a foreign government trying to infiltrate, do you understand? Like that's their job. They would be doing their job if they actually did that. That's not considered spying, as if it was a Russian agent spying on like U.S. assets, right? Mm-hmm. That's spying. When your own intelligence agency is trying to protect the country from foreign actors, that's just intel and counter intel.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a second.
That's what you're here for. Yeah, sure.
So, say right after 9/11, we had the Patriot Act. Would it be considered protecting America to say wiretap the home of, say, a civil rights leader or someone who's active in politics and they're Muslim?
The thing is this, okay, so there is supposed to be due process as a thing, right? You don't, you shouldn't be able to just go in there and on the direction of some field agent or director, install a wiretap. You have to go to a magistrate, you have to go to a judge, you have to get like permission to do it. You have to show probable cause. There has to be some reason. An American Muslim civil rights leader, if there's no probable cause, then no, it doesn't rise to the level of that being okay. I mean, there has to be, if you're going to show that there's some really, let's say they're able to show like there's some suspicious activity in their bank account, there's some suspicious travel, there's some suspicious associations, or some probable cause to say this person might be involved in some kind of criminal activity or, you know, or a national security threat.
Then what about
that is how law enforcement works.
Let me push back a little bit further. What if it's a FBI entrapment sting? What if the person that they're looking at actually had no ties to, you know, any radical groups, but in fact they were sort of extending an opportunity and kind of getting, you know, luring them into a trap, like many operations that actually go. Yeah.
No. Entrapment is not a legitimate use of law enforcement authority, as far as I'm concerned. Entrapment means you trapped somebody, and you basically not just provided an opportunity, but, you know, create, and most of the time entrapment, I mean, I've seen this up close and personal with somebody I know actually, and a couple of clients, in fact. Entrapment happens often with very vulnerable people, people who have maybe mental health issues, people who are very isolated from other community. They don't have legal counsel. They're not very well educated. There's a lot of factors. There's some financial constraints. They might be on the verge of homelessness. I mean, like, there's so many, but they will look, I mean, I know somebody who, this guy's bipolar. He has such serious mental health issues, and the FBI were grooming him to become an informant. And I said to him, and he was very excited. He said, the FBI wants to work with me. And I said to him, I said, because I'm trying to figure out a way to get him to understand what's really happening, because he's not seeing the picture. And I said, if the FBI wants to work with you, you should say, I would love to work for the FBI. Hire me. Because I was like, if they hire you, that's fine. You'll become an FBI agent. Otherwise, what'll happen is they'll use you and then they can entrap you because of your own stupid actions, right?
Right.
Like it can be. And so entrapment is different, but entrapment is not what happened here. Or nobody's been alleging, not even Trump is alleging.
Here's what many Trump loyalists and supporters are alleging, though.
All right,
and,
tell me what
so you're familiar with the FISA court. Mm-hmm. So the FISA court issued a warrant to basically surveil Carter Page, who was a Trump campaign official, as well as, and I want to say George Papadopoulos, I'm not 100% sure on him, but I know that based on what he said to an Australian agent in London about getting Hillary Clinton's emails, that tipped off intelligence agencies in the U.S. because he was speaking to an Australian agent and were allies with the Australians. So that was the alleged, at least the nexus of the, or the impetus, I should say, the beginning of this quote-unquote spying on the Trump campaign. I'm not 100% sure if there was actual spying on Trump campaign at Trump Tower via wiretapping, but knowing Obama and his administration, just by virtue of, you know, the stories that have come out about the NSA and the bulk collection of metadata, it's kind of difficult to rule it out entirely. And seeing as how many intelligence agencies, and you can look at the testimony of Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, two former FBI officials, one an agent, Peter Strzok, and an attorney, Lisa Page, based on their personal correspondence while they were having an affair, Trump loyalists believed that they were orchestrating a quote-unquote coup to overthrow and delegitimize Donald Trump's electoral victory in 2016. So that's sort of
At a time when nobody even realized, including Donald Trump himself, that he might win.
Right. Really? And that's the long and short of it in terms of, for podcast purposes, I'm sure I could talk about this for, several more minutes, but that is sort of the backstory here. And that is why you have people like Devin Nunes referring, upwards to like 8 criminal referrals to the DOJ, hoping that people that he names in them will be prosecuted by the Justice Department. And I'm sure he's going to name a number of, House Democrats, like House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff. So I can't see why some of those people wouldn't be named on the referral list. It would be interesting, obviously, if the DOJ doesn't go through with it, because they allege that there's like a deep state that currently exists in which, the powers that be inside the federal government are trying to maintain the status quo because Trump is such a, he shakes everything up and he ruffles feathers. And I'm trying to look for the right word to describe him, but he basically a wrecking ball to the current system. And that's too much for a lot of these government employees and federal employees to deal with.
Let's not forget that, most of the folks who are like in any kind of executive power, these intelligence agencies were Republicans, right?
But that doesn't matter. The party doesn't matter here because Republicans.
No,
the
but I'm saying
the Trump is not your typical Republican. He's not a conservative. He's a nationalist populist.
Yes, right. But at that point, he's also the nominee, right? He's the nominee at that point. And so the thing is that it's to me, let me ask you this. Okay, the most obvious and innocent explanation is that they were just intelligence. They were law enforcement intelligence agencies doing their job. That's their mandate. If they feel like there's like some kind of foreign infiltration or Page as an agent or like that's what they're supposed to do. What are they supposed to do? Just be like, oh, well, and walk away. Like they're literally doing their jobs.
To respond to that, a lot of Trump supporters believe that the FBI was acting on political reasons and not on objective criminal reasons. Whether they actually thought the Trump campaign or President Trump himself or Donald Trump, I should say at the time, then candidate Trump, was working at the behest of Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. And this is why, so many people have issues with the FBI opening a counterintelligence investigation into Donald Trump after he fired James Comey in May of 2017, because they thought he was working for the Russian government, which is...
Have you seen that chart? I know you've seen it. You've seen the chart that shows how many connections people in Trump's orbit, including his own family, have to Russia, to Russian agents, to Russian authority, to Russian oligarchs. I mean, you've seen that chart, right?
I have not personally seen that chart.
Oh, come on. It's been every. I mean, it's.
I don't know what the source is. I will tweet it at you.
It's just like one big a mass of crossed network wires. There's that much there that would raise any law enforcement or intelligence agency's interests and concerns. And if the intelligence agency's concern is protecting this country from foreign intelligence, foreign influence, they're just doing their job. If you're anything like me, you have a bajillion books that you need to read, and that list keeps getting bigger and bigger, and you desperately want to read them because you want to learn from them, but you just don't have the time. Well, here's the solution for all of that. Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books, which is what I love about it, and distills them down to the most impactful elements. So you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes all on your phone. Look, let's be honest. We read fiction for pleasure. Nonfiction, okay, fine. It can be for pleasure. But most of all, we just kind of want to learn what's in there. What are we being taught in this nonfiction book? And with Blinkist, you can expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. See, I listen to Blinkist, for example, when I'm going on my runs, when I'm doing chores around the house, when I'm driving, I'm on the road all the time, and I travel a lot. So, you know, it's a great way for me to be like, I got 20 minutes, I'm gonna listen to a book. The library is massive. They've got timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich to current bestsellers like Fire and Fury. Now, I am a true crime and murder mystery buff, and so I recently listened to Say Nothing. It's a 2018 book which explores a shocking true story of murder during the North Ireland conflict. It's a fantastic book in general, and you know what? Maybe I might go back and read the whole thing, but for now, in 12 minutes, I got to hear the entire story, and it was fantastic. It just shone a light on some of the key figures in the conflict, as well as that time's most notorious atrocities. And this was all stuff that I just don't know a lot about, and I got a whole lesson on it in 12 minutes. So check it out for sure. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience. Just go to Blinkist.com/45th, and you're going to get a free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/45th, and get your free 7-day trial today. Blinkist.com/45th. Anyway, how do you feel about now what Barr had to say about this? Because let's get back to Barr.
Yeah, sure. I think there's some legitimacy to the idea that the previous administration spied on the Trump campaign. I haven't seen, again, this is just based on personal gut feeling. I have no idea if, based on the evidence that we've seen, you know, with the FISA court, that probably would lend more credibility to the fact that the Trump campaign was spied on. Now, Trump Tower specifically? I'm not 100% sure, but knowing our federal government and how many people that they spied on, including people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, like, it would not surprise me at all. And I think people just need to take a step back that, you know, the FBI and our intelligence agencies, while in the scope of protecting our national security, sometimes they get it wrong, and sometimes they act on, you know, on bad tips. I mean, just look at what happened in Iraq in 2003 with the WMDs. I mean, they got it wrong. I mean, it just happens. It's not, you know, we're all human. It's not like they get it perfect 100% of the time. So, and this is interesting.
But that also counters the idea this is some kind of political, partisan, malicious, you know.
Well, that's the thing about Trump, and that's, you know, I think while there are many straight-laced FBI agents, I think there are some who probably would argue that Trump being in office is such a disruptive force that some people just cannot help themselves but try to stop something like Trump being elected. So that's, I mean,
that, or maybe he really isn't a Russian agent. Okay, like, look, so seriously. Okay, look, like, let me ask you this. What do you think about the refusal to release or the hesitancy at this point to release the Mueller report?
Well, there are a couple of things here. One, they obviously have to redact grand jury information, which, you know, that's one thing. They have to redact sources, sure, and methods. They have to redact, you know, potential third parties who may be, who have their reputations completely tarnished if their names are mentioned in there. I don't know what the legitimacy is behind that. I don't, you know, here's the thing. I really want to see the Mueller report. I don't know if the Trump administration has done enough to really convince me that they don't want to release it, or even Donald Trump. I mean, he said he's fine if the report is released. And this is the thing. I think there are many critics of Trump who believe that releasing the Mueller report would help answer all their questions. It would answer, you know, I really don't think they're going to be satisfied by what they see in the Mueller report, regardless of what it says, even if, you know, there's a lot of damaging information about Trump. Say, like when James Comey decided not to, indict Hillary Clinton over her email server, but like had all this other information, in which he was basically saying how negligent she was and that sort of thing. So like it's there are lines like those that I think Democrats are really trying to seize upon and use that, I think, for political gain and political purposes as we head into election season. And you probably, that's a prediction, and I think that actually will come true. That I feel like that's a fairly easy one to predict.
All right.
What about you? I mean, are you? I can imagine you probably see the other side of that. What's your take?
Well, you know, I mean, there are those reports that are saying that this is that people who worked on the report are saying that it's been mischaracterized by Barr, and that raises my concerns. I think Barr is going to do everything he can to protect this president.
That report, though, coming from Mueller's team, do you think that's coming from Mueller himself?
I don't think so. Really? The reason I don't think, I don't know. That man seems like a fortress to me. I could be wrong here. You know,
like the reason I think that is because he's such a fortress that he would release that type of information and, you know, brand it as Mueller's team. So it could be any number of people.
Yeah, that's true too. And I think his team is also kind of a fortress. Like, there's been no leaks out of this team. I mean,
there was that one leak which he had to basically stamp down by BuzzFeed. It was what was it called? Oh man, it was the one thing that the Mueller team actually had to deny because
I remember something. Yeah,
do you remember what that was? Why am I blanking out on this?
I don't know. It's just like an avalanche.
It's going to drive me insane. It's going to drive our listeners.
Look it up. They are such professionals, you know, there's no hacks involved here. And so I don't know who, but whoever it is.
This is the one. Sorry to cut you off. It was Mueller's office disputes BuzzFeed report that Trump directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress. Completely forgot about that one.
Yeah. And if that, right. And that is, again, contrary to the idea there's a witch hunt going on here. But the point is that, you know, this leak or this information that came out saying that no, Barr's summation is not an accurate reflection. There was then no counter to that. It's not like then there's another leak or report or some information dropped to a reporter saying, actually, that's not true. It is inaccurate. That's just out there, right? So as long as it's out there and there's silence, that means there's some truth to it. And I do think this attorney general is going to protect the president at all costs. I think if, the privileged stuff that needs to be redacted gets redacted, at a minimum, our legislators should be able to see the whole report. Now, whether or not the entire American public needs to see it, maybe not, but our elected officials must see it. I mean, I just don't understand.
No, I fully expect them to get it. I mean, I don't know if it's going to drop today or this weekend. You know, if it drops this weekend, then all hell is going to break loose like it did a couple of weeks ago when, you know, Barr sent that memo to Congress. But, you know, sort of, I kind of want to move on to the other Mueller news.
I recently saw the most amazing video on Twitter. It was of a cat rubbing up against and brushing its teeth, literally brushing its teeth up against a mounted Quip brush. And believe me, Kitty, I totally get it. Because one of the most important things that we do for our health every single day is brushing our teeth, for cats included. But the thing is, most of us don't do it properly, and that's why I love Quip. That's why this cat loves Quip. I think you can just Google it, but you gotta find video of this cat brushing its teeth with a Quip toothbrush. Quip it's my favorite toothbrush. It's my favorite electric toothbrush because it's been designed by dentists and engineers. It travels all over the country with me, all over the world. I have taken my Quip toothbrush. Let's see, where have I taken it? I've taken it to London. I've taken it to Abu Dhabi. That thing gets around, and I love it because it keeps my teeth clean and healthy in a way that no other electric toothbrush has ever done so, because I don't have to worry about changing the heads, about, you know, keeping it up to date. What I love the most about Quip is that the brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for $5. That's how affordable it is. So the way it works is the Quip brush has these sensitive sonic vibrations. It's very sensitive. If you have sensitive gums, you don't have to worry about it. And a lot of electric toothbrushes, by the way, are a little too abrasive. I mean, like, I have one electric toothbrush. I will not name names, but when I put toothpaste on it and I turn it on, the toothpaste goes flying. That does not happen with your Quip toothbrush. It also has a built-in 2-minute timer, and it pulses every 30 seconds, so you know it's time to switch sides. There you go, 2 minutes, done. Switch sides 4 times, you're done. And again, there's that mount, and you'll see that in the video. There's this little mount you put up. So in the future, put your mount in a place maybe where if you don't want to share it with your cats and dogs, they can't get to it. But the mount's great. You could put up on a mirror, you could put up on the wall, and put your toothbrush in there, handy little place to store your toothbrush. There is a reason that this toothbrush is accepted by the American Dental Association and has thousands of verified 5-star reviews. So check out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25. It's that affordable. And if you go to getquip.com/45th, your first refill pack will be free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack absolutely free at getquip, getquip.com/45th.
So off the beaten path a bit from looking into the Trump White House was an indictment that was handed down against the former general counsel of the Obama White House, Gregory Craig.
I missed that.
Yeah. So he was indicted on Thursday. So he was indicted on Thursday on charges of lying and hiding information related to his work for Ukraine. Now, Craig, who's 74, was charged by the DOJ's Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, similar to what got former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort in hot water with Mueller that led to a criminal conviction. And the Trump White House was taking a victory lap around this with Kellyanne Conway tweeting, "Breaking news, finally, White House official indicted in connection with Mueller investigation." And seeing how this is the first time you're hearing about it, what's your immediate takeaway? I mean, I'm not 100% sure how much you know about Gregory Craig.
I don't, but I do personally believe, and I know people who work for DOJ, and I think they're professionals. And so I think if this indictment happened, I think there's an investigation against this guy, then I believe that it's probably credible and legitimate. So it doesn't, I mean, it's of concern, obviously, that this could be the reality, that there was like the White House flipping general counsel was working for Ukraine without registering for it. I mean, and I have to wonder to what extent that had any impact. I mean, did it have any impact on the administration's policy itself towards Ukraine and Russia?
I don't know. It was the work he did in 2012. I'm not 100% sure if it really, I mean, he did some lobbying work for them. I wouldn't say it's anything. I don't think it's as much different as Paul Manafort's case with the lobbying he did for Ukrainian oligarchs who had, you know, sympathetic ties to Vladimir Putin. I'm sort of still, there's still more information coming out about this. There's not, I mean, the thing is,
yeah,
there hasn't been a whole lot of, there hasn't been a whole lot more reporting on this particular indictment because I think a lot of people kind of see it as a one-off. But it's weird in a way because it's sort of like during the Starr investigation when they were looking into Whitewater, they ended up uncovering something like the Monica Lewinsky affair.
Right.
So it was just something that completely, it's not going to make obviously as big news to say something like Monica Lewinsky, but, you know, still, I mean, pretty big deal to indict the general counsel of the Obama White House.
No, it's it is. It's a big deal. It would be a big deal in any other situation. I just think, given, like I said, kind of the avalanche of news that's comes out daily under this administration, it is not getting that much attention. I just haven't seen anything about it at all. But again, I've been traveling. So it could just be missed it. But you are a journalist and you haven't seen a lot of it. So there's that.
Well, it hasn't been. I mean, it's not front page news, but it was breaking.
I'm sure there's something there. I mean, like, look. And because I haven't read the indictment, because I don't know like the facts of the case, it could be a matter of just failing to register, like something kind of bureaucratic, or it could be something a little more serious and nefarious. And I just don't know. So I can't really comment.
I mean, the idea that Obama or the Obama White House had, you know, the same sort of stain that the Trump White House did with respect to Russia. I mean, that's it's kind of.
I mean, but we don't know. I don't know if this guy, if his actions rose to like the level of like what Manafort did for years, if not decades. I just don't know. And then Manafort obviously got himself further in trouble by lying and lying and lying and lying.
Oh, for sure. Let's talk about the final story here. And this is sort of not entirely relating to, you know, what's happening in the Trump White House, but I'm sure it'll travel up to the White House eventually. And this just has to do with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's recent comments about the September 11th terrorist attacks which she's
always on his radar. So, yeah,
she was speaking at a CARE banquet in Los Angeles, CARE being the Council on American Islamic Relations. And she spoke at this CARE banquet and said,
CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties.
And it was the some people who did something was the line that people, and part of my French, lost their shit over. Mm-hmm. Now, I personally feel Ilhan Omar's slightly, I think her comments were slightly inarticulate. I wouldn't, obviously, the New York Post sort of went over the top in posting an image of the Twin Towers as they were being attacked and saying, Ilhan Omar, here's your something. And just, you know, to fact check Ilhan Omar a bit more, CARE was not founded after 9/11.
I was
going to
say
1994.
CARE has been around a lot longer than that. CARE's been. And for folks who don't know, CARE is kind of like the equivalent of the NAACP for American Muslim community. I have been highly critical of them in many, many different ways. There's some great state chapters. Their national is just a shit show, but anyway.
Full disclosure, my brother worked for them. The Oklahoma chapter, which he was the executive director of, had nothing to do with the national chapter.
Everybody loves to say that. We have nothing to do with the national.
and he actually did really great work in Oklahoma. I would say from like 2007 to 2009. And then CARE sort of went off the deep end. And once you sort of mix like religion and politics, that's when you start to lose me. And this is probably why I think Rabia, you, me and Waj are sort of like not excommunicated, but not really. We're sort of on our own. We're kind of blazing our own trail because we aren't afraid to sort of speak our minds about when people are sort of messing up and like saying the wrong things. And so,
at the end of the day, this is our community. We've come out of it. We've grown through it. We understand it. We know it, and we love it. And part of that love is saying, you are screwing this up. This is how you're getting this wrong. And that's why, from an institutional perspective, yes. But people, they still love us. That's okay, Siraj.
So putting that into perspective with our listeners, Ilhan Omar's comments, I feel were, again, they're inarticulate. I would not say they were malicious. Anything ignorant. And I haven't been shy to kind of call her out. I thought her comments about Israel in the past have traversed into anti-Semitic territory. I've even gotten death threats over calling her out. And what's interesting is that, you know, while Omar brings an interesting perspective and people say that she's, you know, changing the conversation about how we deal with Israel. Yeah, she has. I do think she's sort of the wrong messenger to bring that because the whole idea of, you know, Israel has hypnotized the world. This is a tweet I'm referencing back in 2012 that she posted. It really plays up an ugly anti-Semitic trope in which Jews are trying to take over the world. And so there's been a lot of, you know, comments coming from her camp in which she's sort of, you know, said things and doesn't really step back to sort of issue a clarification, and many times she doubles down. But there was one time in which she clarified and actually apologized, and that was when she made comments about the Benjamins. And that's when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and a lot of Democrats came down hard on her.
They did, but they also held her hand, and they didn't throw her completely under the bus. Wajahat and I wrote an op-ed about this, and we agree that we don't believe that this is deliberate, malicious anti-Semitism. It really comes from a place of ignorance, and I say that because I know I was there. And, you know, it's interesting. I just had a I was part of a meeting earlier this week of Jewish and Muslim leaders, where what we're working on is actually a conference that's going to educate our communities from leadership down on anti-Semitism within Muslim communities and anti-Muslim bigotry within Jewish communities, because oftentimes it's not malicious. Oftentimes we have no idea how things are landing. We don't know what the tropes mean to the other community.
100%.
And that's what it is. That is an education process. I had to be taught kinds of language that I used was anti-Semitic. And all that does is allow me to then make better, more informed, more principled criticisms of Israel if I need to.
Yeah. The one thing I will say now, just that, you know, knowing that Omar has said these things and she's been called out on it and she's apologized, the thing that she really hurt herself on is that she no longer gets the benefit of the doubt when she says something in the future that could be construed or blatantly interpreted as anti-Semitic. So,
well, I hope by now, and I don't know, but I really hope by now she has good enough advisors. Like some people, I know there are people in the Jewish community who have come to her side and said, let us tell you why. And that's why she apologized about that one tweet. Yeah. I hope she has enough people in her, you know, in her surroundings that she can run things by them first and kind of unpack it before she makes any comments. But I do think there's also an English thing. I think there is a bit of the inarticulateness around this particular statement, because let's get back to this for a second.
Yeah.
Is not so much, again, a dismissal or minimizing of the horrific attacks of 9/11, but I can totally see, like, people I know for whom English is a second language kind of just you saying it like that without meaning to minimize it.
Yeah, no, and I can completely get that. I mean, I know her English is not her first language. But yeah, she's been kind of, you know, she's the new scapegoat of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, she is.
I feel like she's actually superseding Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as, like, the main punching bag now. You know, you have hundreds of people protesting her.
She's Muslim. Even so, at the banquet.
She's
a triple threat. She's a woman, she's a Muslim, she's black. I mean,
I think so. Dan Crenshaw, another congressman, Republican from Texas, he's a former Navy SEAL. He retweeted a snippet of Omar's remarks on Tuesday, writing, quote, first member of Congress to ever describe terrorists who killed thousands of Americans on 9/11 as, quote, some people who did something, end quote, unbelievable, end quote. Sorry, I said that end quote twice. I don't know why. So the next day, Brian Kilmeade, the host of Fox and Friends, he questioned Omar's loyalty, saying, quote, you have to wonder if she is an American first, end quote. And those comments echoed those made recently by another Fox host, Jeanine Pirro, who questioned her Americanness over her wearing hijab, which is, for people who are not familiar, Muslim head covering for women. So I think what's interesting that, and you probably would agree, Rabia, is that the responses to Omar's comments or rhetoric or what have you oftentimes is an overreaction to the crime. So, like, it's just, you know, as soon as she opens her mouth, boom, she's not American enough. Boom, she's, you know, loyal to the terrorists or loyal to Al-Qaeda or something like that. It's gotten to the point where it's the type of responses that many members of the quote unquote resistance have towards Donald Trump. Whenever he says something or does something, it's like, orange man bad, that kind of thing.
Orange man is bad. that's the difference. Orange man is like, I grab women by their private. I mean, like, there's that man has laid his own trail. But I understand what you're saying. There are times when we are waiting to pounce on every single thing. We're examining every single thing. She's certainly low hanging fruit. To that end, I wonder about something. Do you think, well, the problem is this, she's an elected official. She can't not make public statements. She's going to be giving talks like she was giving this talk. You know, she's going to be giving media, doing media. You can't expect her to just be completely silent on all the time. But her overexposure, I wonder if it's because she is constantly putting herself in it, or it's just like there's a spotlight on her that she wishes she didn't have to deal with constantly.
A part of her, and this is interesting that you bring this up, because there are some people who really do sort of they bask in the spotlight. You know, they actually they find some sort of satisfaction in making.
They really welcome the attacks. They welcome
It's like a badge of honor to some people to you know, ruffle all these feathers. And I'd say AOC is probably one of them. I'd say maybe Ilhan Omar is possibly another. Trump's definitely one. He just loves triggering everybody just because he can. And then they complain about like negative coverage later. So it's sort of like a endless cycle in which, you know, they say something, you know, they get bad press, they complain about the bad press, and that sort of reinforces their position and sort of helps garner them more support, because they kind of turn themselves into a victim at the end of the cycle, and then it sort of repeats from then on.
I'll be honest. I feel like with Ilhan, I mean, I hate to say, I can't believe I'm going to say it, but I want to say it. I feel like there are.
Say it, Rabia.
You know, when you say she's the wrong messenger on certain things, I really think she's been pushed. She's being pushed by people, I would say, even from the American Muslim community, even from the very progressive left, to become a mouthpiece on things where Rashida Tlaib is much more measured and smart on this, where she's Palestinian American. Right. Why isn't she the one in the forefront of these, you know, comments around Israel and the elections and all this stuff? She's not. She is more politically savvy, and I don't think Ilhan Omar is. And in fact, I had a conversation with somebody who is from Ilhan's community, who knows Ilhan for many, many years. This guy is very well situated, you know, and he's like, I think she's kind of being used. She's hurting her own political career by some of the stuff. And but I will say this. This was, to me, this was a talk she's giving to a closed, you know, private event. This was not her asking for a shitstorm to follow her. That wasn't this. But there are times, I think, when she makes statements on things that she easily could just stay quiet on and instead work the legislative channels, you know, like put in a little bit of more foundational work for a political career, and just do it smarter, like some of her colleagues. Because at the end of the day, my fear is that this is not, she might gain sympathy right now, but I don't know if she's going to win another election.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And Tlaib is playing the long game for sure. I mean, she's in a very safe blue district. I would say that, I mean, Omar is in a safe blue district, but she definitely has a target on her back from more moderate Democrats and Republicans. Yeah. I can imagine that she would get primaried in 2020 and she might get unseated. But the thing is, she's an American citizen by birth. She can be president. Ilhan Omar was not born in the United States. She was a refugee from Somalia, so she cannot be president. So think about just the long game here.
Right.
If Ilhan Omar wants to maintain longevity, her best chance is getting the spotlight via Congress and then cashing out into the private sector and forever being a force in the political world from outside of the public sector. And that is what I think most people in Congress's job is that's kind of like the play that most of them go for, because you see so many people in media now who served maybe one or two terms in Congress.
Ilhan Omar is going to limit herself to care banquets if this is the path. I mean, that's how I feel.
I think there are many people in the progressive circles who have embraced Omar, and she probably has a little bit more of a welcoming crowd and on the left than just care banquets. I mean, there are people who are still very passionate about Israel-Palestinian issues. So, like, it's not going to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that is...
Unless Jared Kushner...
How lucrative. I guess what I'm trying to get at is how lucrative of a career can you have on those issues? You can't. And I'm not saying it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be... Like, if you're saying that could be her, that's what she's probably looking at, that also doesn't line up. I think that work is important. It's usually a labor of love, and it's unpaid, and it is just, you know, you're just being an activist on certain issues. They're not going to cash out. You're not cashing out working on Israel Palestine.
I mean, like, if she goes to a think tank, then she's absolutely cashing out.
Do you know how much people make at think tanks? I've worked at a think tank. But
now that she's like a higher up, I mean, people can make, I mean, right, she could probably make a crap ton of money. She can also sell a lot of books too, I'm
sure. She has to be, even for the most progressive think tanks, which is where, I mean, I was at New America Foundation, you have to be a bit more centrist on these issues or a little more measured. Look, like you said at the top of this discussion, she's been put on notice when it comes to the Israel-Palestine stuff, on the anti-Semitic stuff, more specifically. So let's see where that goes. I think she did the right thing. She wrote an op-ed. She apologized. She did the right thing. Now, she was then, like, destroyed for doing the right thing in many of the pro-Palestinian circles. There's that. And also, she tweeted about their two-state solution, and that is also not acceptable.
That's the thing. Yeah.
There's just a no-win situation on this stuff.
Well, yeah, because the two-state solution completely goes against the BDS movement.
Yeah.
So.
And no win. It's all lose when it comes to Israel-Palestine. I have learned that. I swear to God, I have. All right. All lose. All right. Well, thank you so much, Siraj, for that great discussion. We went for I think the whole hour, which I didn't expect.
But for a whole hour, yeah.
Good job. And would love to have you back sometime soon. And thank you for carrying us through. And Susan and Waj, we hope you feel better soon. Yeah, I hope my child stops vomiting.
Yeah, get some sleep.
I took meds last night. I took all the drugs. It was great. Good.
Take more drugs.
More drugs. That's going to be what are you running, Siraj? You know, we're all waiting for that.
I just, you know, whatever helps you feel better, I'm for it.
Well, you know what? That'll be my attorney general campaign slogan when I run for AG. More drugs.
No, but you know, my 2020 policy platform is just imposing Sharia law on people, specifically the haters and losers who don't like Muslims and don't want Sharia in America. And that's it. That's what I'm running.
Basically, no Sharia law for Muslims.
No Sharia law for Muslims. It's Sharia law for all the Nazis.
Only Sharia law for the Nazis. No more bacon for you. No more bacon.
But not the cool non-Muslims. You know, it's only the non-Muslims who really don't want Muslims.
The Nazis. The Nazis. Yes, exactly. That's how I... Thanks again, Siraj. You have a good weekend, and hopefully we'll chat soon. All right, take care. Soon. A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.